on the pad and unroll it. Turn and unroll the carpet. Drag all the furniture back. According to my daily planner book, this shouldn't take me more than a half an hour. Instead, I just fluff the traffic patterns in the carpet and untie the strand of fringe the people I work for tied in a knot. I tied another strand on the opposite end of the rug, so the whole thing looks rotated. I move all the furniture a little and put ice in the little divots left in the carpet. As the ice melts, the matted divots will fluff back up. I scuff the shine off my shoes. At the makeup mirror of the woman I work for, I put her mascara up inside each nostril until my nose hairs look thick and full. Then I catch a bus. Another part of the Survivor Retention Program is you get a free bus pass every month. Stamped on the back of the pass, it says, "Property of the Department of Human Resources. Non-transferable." The whole way to the mausoleum, I'm telling myself I don't give a shit if fertility shows up or not. A lot of half-gone church district prayers recite themselves in my mind. My head is just a mishmash of old prayers and responses. May I be of complete and utmost service. Let my every task be my grace. In my every labor lies my salvation. Let my effort not be wasted. Through my works, may I save the world. Really, I'm thinking, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, be there this afternoon, Fertility Hollis. Inside the mausoleum front doors, there's the usual cheap reproductions of real beautiful music to make you feel not so alone. It's the same 10 songs, only with just the music and no singing. They don't play it except for certain days. Some of the old galleries in the Sincerity and New Hope wings never have the music. You don't hear it anywhere unless you really listen. Its music is wallpaper, utilitarian, music as Prozac or Xanax to control how you feel. Music as aerosol room freshener. I walk through the Serenity wing and don't see fertility. I go through faith, joy, and tranquility, and she's not here. I swipe some plastic roses off some dead person's crypt so I won't show up empty-handed. I'm headed into hatred, anger, fear and resignation, and there, standing at crypt 678 in contentment, is Fertility Hollis with her red hair. She waits until I've been walked up next to her for 240 seconds before she turns and says hi. She can't be the same person who was screaming her orgasm at me over the phone. I say, hi. In her hands is a bunch of fake orange blossoms. Nice enough, but nothing I'd bother to steal. Her dress today is the same kind of brocade they make curtains out of, patterned white on white background. It looks stiff and flame retardant, stain repellent, wrinkle resistant. Mother of the bride modest in her pleated skirt with long sleeves, she says, "Do you miss him too?" Everything about her looks martyr-proofed. I ask, "Miss who?" "Trevor," she says. She's barefoot on the stone floor. Yeah, right. Trevor, I tell myself. My secret sodomite lover. I forgot. I say, "Yeah, I miss him too." Her hair looks gathered in a field and piled on her head to dry. "Did he ever tell you about the cruise he took me on?" "No. It was completely illegal." She looks from crypt number 678 to up at the ceiling where the music comes down from the little speakers next to the painted-on clouds and angels. "First, he made me take dancing lessons with him. We learned all the ballroom dances they call the cha-cha and the foxtrot, the rumba and the swing, the waltz. The waltz was easy." The angels play their music above us for a minute, telling her something, and Fertility Hollis listens. "Here," she says, and turns to me. She takes my flowers and hers and puts them against the wall. She asks, "You can waltz, right?" "Wrong." "I can't believe you could know Trevor and not know how to waltz," she says, and shakes her head. In her head, there's a picture of Trevor and me dancing together, laughing together, having anal sex. This is the handicap I'm up against. This and the idea I killed her brother. She says, "Open your arms." And I do. She's come in face to face close with me and cups one hand on the back of my neck. Her other hand grabs my hand and pulls it out far away from us. She says, "Take your other hand and put it against my bra." So I do. "On my back," she says, and twists away from me. "Put your hand on my bra where it crosses my spine." So I do. For our feet, she shows me how to step forward with my left foot, then my right foot, then bring my feet together while she does this all in the opposite direction. "It's called a box step," she says. "Now listen to the music." She counts. 1, 2, 3. The music goes. 1, 2, 3. We count over and over, and step each time we count and we're dancing. The flowers and all the crypts up and down the walls lean out over us. The marble smooths under our feet. We're dancing. The light is through stained glass windows. The statues are carved in their niches. The music comes out speakers weak and echoes off the stone until it's moving back and forth in drafts and currents, notes and chords around us, and we're dancing. "What I remember about the cruise," Fertility says, and her arm is curved to rest against the whole length of my arm. "I remember the faces of the last passengers as their lifeboats were lowered past the ballroom windows. Their orange canvas life vests sort of framed their heads, so their heads looked cut off and put on orange pillows, and they just stared with big wide-open fish eyes at Trevor and me still inside the ship's ballroom while the ship was starting to sink." She was on a sinking boat. "A ship," Fertility says. "It was called the Ocean Excursion. Try to say that 3 times fast. And it was sinking. "It was beautiful," she says. "The travel agent said not to come crying back to her. It was an old French line ship. The travel agent warned us, only now it was sold to some outfit in South America. It was very Art Deco. It was trashed. It was the Chrysler Building floating sideways in the ocean and cruising up and down the Atlantic coast of South America, full of lower-middle-class people from Argentina and their wives and kids. Argentinians. All the light fixtures on the walls were pink glass shaped into gigantic marquee-cut diamond shapes. Everything on the ship was in this pink diamond light, and the carpets had big stains and worn-out spots." We're dancing in place, and then we start to turn. The 1, 2, 3 box step of it. The forward and back of the hesitation step. The lift of the heel in a perfect bit of Cuban step 2-3. I turn with Fertility Hollis bent inside the hug of my arm. We turn again and again. We turn again. Turn again. Turn again. And Fertility says how the lifeboats were gone. All the lifeboats were gone. And the ship trailed its empty lifeboat rigging in the relaxed Caribbean evening. The lifeboats rowed off into the sunset, the crowd in their orange life vests starting to wail and scam for their jewelry and prescriptions. People were doing that sign of the cross thing. Fertility and I 1, 2, 3 waltz 2, 3 across the marble gallery. In her story, Fertility and Trevor waltzed across the tilting mahogany parquet, the Versailles ballroom tilting as the bow sank, and the stern pointed the 4-leaf clovers of each clover-leaf propeller into the evening air. A flock of little gilt ballroom chairs hurried past them and collected under a statue of that Greek moon goddess, Diana. The gold brocade curtains hung crooked across each window. They were the last passengers aboard the SS Ocean Excursion. The steam was still up because the pink chandeliers, just like regular chandeliers, Fertility says, but on an ocean liner, they hang rigid as icicles. The chandeliers in the Versailles ballroom sparkled, and the public address system still filled the ship with a crackling music, one after another of elevator waltzes melting into each other as Trevor and Fertility turned, turned, turned. As Fertility and I turn, turn and step in place, then slide toe to toe across the mausoleum floor. Below decks, the Caribbean was rising in the Trianon dining room, floating the edges of 100 linen tablecloths. The ship was drifting with all engines dead. The warm blue water was spread out flat to the horizon in every direction. Under even a little water, the checkerboard floor of mahogany and walnut parquet looked lost and out of reach. Here was one last look at the continent of Atlantis, with salt water rising around the statues and the marble pillars as Trevor and Fertility waltzed past the legend of a lost civilization, gold-painted carvings and carved French palace tables. Sea level rose diagonal against life-sized paintings of queens wearing crowns as the ship tilted and vases spilled flowers. Roses and orchids and stalks of ginger into the water where bottles of champagne bobbed and Trevor and Fertility splashed past. The metal skeleton of the ship, the bulkheads behind the lining of paneling and tapestries, shuddered and groaned. I ask, was she going to drown herself?
Don't be stupid, Fertility says with her head against my chest, breathing the poison smell all over me. Trevor was never wrong. That was his whole problem.
Never wrong about what? Trevor Hollis had dreams, she told me. He'd dream a plane was going to crash. Trevor would tell the airline, and no one would believe him. Then, the plane would crash and the FBI would bring him in for questioning. It was always easier to believe he was a terrorist than a psychic. The dreams got so he couldn't sleep. He didn't dare read a newspaper, or watch television, or he'd see the report of some 200 people dying in a plane crash he knew would happen, but couldn't stop. He couldn't save anybody.
Our mom killed herself because she had the same kind of dreams, Fertility says. Suicide is an old family tradition for us.
Still dancing, I tell myself. At least we have something in common.
He knew the ship was only going to sink about halfway. Some valve or something was going to fail, and water would fill the engine rooms and some of the big public rooms on the lower decks, Fertility says. He knew from his dreams that we'd have hours with the whole ship to ourselves. We'd have all that food and wine. Then someone would come along to rescue us.
Still dancing, I ask. Is that why he killed himself? The music is my only answer for a minute.
You can't imagine how beautiful it all was. The flooded ballrooms with pianos underwater and all the needlepoint furniture floating around. Fertility says against my chest. It was my nicest memory ever.
We dance past statues of saints and somebody else's religion. To me, they're just rock shaped into glorified nobodies.
The Atlantic water was so clear, it was pouring down the grand staircase, she says. We just took off our shoes and kept dancing.
Still dancing, counting 1 to 3, I ask, does she have the same kind of dreams?
A little bit, she says. Not very much. More and more all the time. More than I want to.
I ask, so is she going to kill herself the same as her brother?
No,
Fertility says. She lifts her head and smiles at me. We dance. 1, 2, 3. She says,
no way I would shoot myself. I'd probably take pills.
At home is my stash of government-issue antidepressants. Hypnotics, mood equalizers, sedatives, MAO inhibitors in the candy dish beside my goldfish on my fridge. We dance 1, 2, 3, she says.
Just kidding.
We dance. She puts her head back on my chest and says,
it all depends on how terrible my dreams get.
37. It's that night I start answering the phone again. This is after I'm so horny I have to go downtown and hunt for something to steal. This isn't so much for the cash as to get off. It's okay. The caseworker says it's okay. It's a sexual release, she tells me. It's perfectly natural. You find what you want. You stalk it. You grab it and make it your own. After you've had it, you throw it away.
It was the caseworker who got me started shoplifting in the first place. The caseworker called me a textbook example of kleptomania. She cited studies. My stealing, she said, was to prevent anybody from stealing my penis. Finical, 1945. Stealing was an impulse I couldn't control. Goldman, 1991. I stole because of a mood disorder. McElroy and others, 1991. It didn't matter what. Shoes, masking tape, a tennis racket. The only trouble is now even stealing doesn't give me the old feeling of wow. Maybe this is because I've met fertility. Or maybe I've met fertility because I'm getting bored with my sex life of crime. Lately, I'm not even shoplifting. Not in the classic, formal sense. Instead of stealing merchandise, I'll walk around downtown until I find a cash register receipt someone's just dropped. You take the receipt into the store it's from. You pretend to shop until you find an item on the receipt. You take the item around the store for a while, then you use the receipt to return the item for cash. Of course, this works best in big stores. It works best with itemized receipts. Don't use receipts that are old or dirty. Don't use the same receipt twice. Try to vary the stores you scam. This is to real shoplifting what masturbation is to sex. And of course, stores know all about this scam. Other good scams include shopping with a big cup of soda you can drop small items into. Another way is to buy a cheap can of paint, then loosen the lid and drop something expensive inside. The metal of the can blocks the X-rays from the security system. This afternoon, instead of finding a receipt, I just walk around trying to figure out the next part of my plan to grab fertility and make her my own. Have her. Throw her away, maybe. I have to take advantage of her terrible dreams. Our dancing together has to be a tool I can use. Fertility and I danced most of the afternoon. As the music changed, she taught me the basic cha-cha, the cha-cha crossover step, and the female underarm cha-cha turn. She showed me the basic foxtrot. She told me what she did for a living was terrible. It was worse than anything I could imagine. And when I asked, "What?" she laughed. Walking around downtown, I find a register receipt for a color television. This should feel like I found a winning lottery ticket, but I put the receipt in a trash can. Maybe what I liked most about dancing is the rules. In the world where anything goes, here are solid, arbitrary rules. The foxtrot is two slow steps and two fast. The cha-cha is two slow and three fast. The choreography, the discipline, isn't up for debate. These are good old-fashioned rules. How to dance the box step isn't going to change every week. To the caseworker, when we started together 10 years ago, I wasn't a crook. Originally, I was an obsessive-compulsive disorder. She'd just got her degree and still had all her textbooks to prove it. Obsessive-compulsive, she told me, would either check on things or clean them. Rockman and Hodgson, 1980. According to her, I was the second kind. Really, I just like to clean. But all my life, I've been trained to obey. All I did was try and make her lousy diagnosis look right. The caseworker told me the symptoms, and I did my best to manifest them and then let her cure me. After being obsessive-compulsive, I was post-traumatic stress disorder. Then I was agoraphobic. I was a panic disorder. My feet are walking down the sidewalk in the one slow, two fast step of a waltz. My head is counting. One, two, three. My head is counting. One, two, three. Wherever you look among the pigeons, there are big ticket receipts all over the sidewalk. Walking around downtown, I pick up another receipt. This one's good for $173 cash. Then I throw it away. For about 3 months after I first met the caseworker, I was a dissociative identity disorder because I wouldn't tell the caseworker about my childhood. Then, I was a schizotypal personality disorder because I didn't want to join her weekly therapy group. Then, because she thought it would make a good case study, I had Corot syndrome, where you're convinced your penis is getting smaller and smaller, and when it disappears, you'll die. Fabian, 1991. Thang and others, 1992. Then, she switched me to have Dot syndrome, where you're in crisis over the belief you're losing all your sperm when you have wet dreams or take a leak. Chada and Ahuja, 1990. This is based on an old Hindu belief that it takes 40 drops of blood to create a drop of bone marrow, and 40 drops of marrow to create a drop of sperm. Akhtar, 1988. She said it was no wonder I was so tired all the time. Sperm makes me think of sex, makes me think of punishment, makes me think of death, makes me think of Fertility Hollis. We did what the caseworker called free association. Every session we had, she diagnosed me with another problem she thought I might have, and she gave me a book so I could study the symptoms. By the next week, I had whatever the problem was down pat. 1 week, pyromaniac. 1 week, gender identity disorder. She told me I was an exhibitionist, so the next week, I mooned her. She told me I was attention deficient, so I kept changing the subject. I was claustrophobic, so we had to meet outside on the patio. Walking around downtown, my feet switched to the too slow, three fast, too slow step of a cha-cha. In my head is the same 10 songs we listened to all afternoon. I pass up another receipt, as legal tender, as a $5 bill on the sidewalk, and I cha-cha right past it. The book the caseworker gave me was called The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. We called it the DSM for short. She gave me a lot of her old textbooks to read, and inside were color photographs of models getting paid to look happy by holding naked babies overhead or walking hand in hand on a beach at sunset. For pictures of misery, models were getting paid to needle illegal drugs into their arms or slump alone at a table with a drink. It got so the caseworker could throw the DSM on the floor and whatever page it fell open to, that was how I'd try to look for the week. We were happy enough this way, for a while. She felt she was making progress every week. I had a script to tell me how to act. It wasn't boring, and she gave me too many fake problems for me to stress about anything real. Every Tuesday, the caseworker would give me her diagnosis, and that was my new assignment. Our first year together, there wasn't enough free time for me to consider suicide. We did the Stanford-Binet to figure out how old my brain was. We did the Wechsler. We did the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. The Millen Clinical Multiaxial Inventory. The Beck Depression Inventory. The caseworker found out everything about me except for the truth. I just didn't want to be fixed. Whatever my real problems might be, I didn't want them cured. None of the little secrets inside me wanted to be found and explained away by myths, by my childhood, by chemistry. My fear was, what would be left? So none of my real grudges and dreads ever came out into the light of day. I didn't want to resolve any angst. I never talked about my dead family. Expressed my grief, she called it. Resolve it. Leave it behind. The caseworker cured me of 100 syndromes, none of them real, and then declared me sane. She was so happy and proud. She sent me out into the light of day cured. You are healed. Go forth. Walk. A miracle of modern psychology. Arise. Dr. Frankenstein and her monster. It was pretty heady stuff when you're 25 years old. The only side effect is now I tend to steal. My intro to kleptomania felt too good to leave behind. Until tonight. Walking around downtown 10 years later, I pick up another receipt. I throw it away. After 10 years of stowing away my problems so the caseworker couldn't monkey around with them, all I have to do is dance the cha-cha with some girl, and even my chronic stealing is gone. My one real psychosis I denied the caseworker is cured by a stranger. That's all we did was dance. Fertility talked about her brother and how the FBI had his phone tapped so every time she talked to him, she could hear the click, click, click of a government tape recorder in the background. Even before Trevor killed himself, she knew he would. It was in her first dream of the future. Fertility and I danced some more. Then she had to leave. Then she promised next week, next Wednesday, same time, same place, she'd be there. Tonight, streetlight to streetlight, I walk the foxtrot. In my mind, I hear the waltz. The memory of Fertility Hollis is in my arms and resting against my chest. This is how I get home. Upstairs, the phone is already ringing off the hook. Maybe it's schizoids, paranoids, pedophiles. Been there, I want to tell them. Done that. Maybe it's Fertility Hollis wanting to talk about dancing with me today. Ready to give me her second impression of me. Maybe she'll tell me in secret what's so terrible she does to earn money. All the way from the elevator doors coming open, I run to answer the phone. Hello? The apartment door to the hallway is still open behind me. The fish needs to be fed. The curtains are still open, and it's almost dark outside. Anyone could see in here. A man on the other end says, "May you be of complete service in your lifetime." Without a thought, I respond, "Praise and glory to the Lord for this day through which we labor." He says, "May our efforts bring all those around us to heaven." I ask, "Who is this?" And he says, "May you die with all your work complete." And he hangs up. 36. There's a way to polish chrome with club soda. To clean the ivory or bone handles on cutlery, rub them with lemon juice and salt. To get the shine off a suit, dampen the cloth with a weak mixture of water and ammonia. Then, iron with a damp pressing cloth. The secret for making perfect bœuf bourguignon is to add some orange peel. To remove cherry stains, rub them with a ripe tomato and wash as usual. The key is not to panic. To make pants, keep a sharp crease, turn them inside out, and rub a bar of soap on the inside of the crease. Turn them right side out, and iron as usual. The trick is to keep busy. Despite the fact the killer called, I'm doing everything as usual. The secret is to not let your imagination get carried away. All night long, I'm cleaning. I can't sleep. To clean the oven, I'm baking a pan of ammonia. Another way to put a lasting crease in pants is to dampen your pressing cloth with water and vinegar. I dig today's dirt out from under each fingernail. If I don't open a window, I'm going to suffocate from the smell of baked ammonia. Here, I have to just spit it out. The caseworker is missing. Every 10 minutes I call the caseworker at her office, and all I get is her message. Here's the first time in 10 years I've called her, and this is all I hear.
Please leave a message at the beep.
I say, that crazy psycho she told me about. Well, he called. All night, I'm phoning her office every 10 minutes. Please leave a message at the beep. She needs to get me some protection. And her message machine keeps cutting me off, so I call back. Please leave a message. I need an armed 24-hour police escort. Please leave a message. Somebody could be in the hallway and I need to use the bathroom. Please leave a message. The killer she told me about knows who I am. He called. He knows where I live. He has my telephone number. Please leave a message. Call me. Call me. Call me. Please leave a message. If I turn up suicided in the morning, it was murder. Please leave a message. If I end up dead from some murderer holding my head in the oven, it's because she never checked her messages. Please leave a message. Listen, I tell her machine, this is for real. This is not a paranoid delusion. She cured me of those, remember? Please leave a message. This isn't a schizoid fantasy. I'm not hallucinating. Take my word for it. Please leave a message. Then her message tape runs out. All night, I'm awake and listening with the refrigerator moved halfway in front of the hall door. I need to use the bathroom, but not bad enough to risk my life. People go down the hallway, but nobody stops. Nobody touches my doorknob all night. The phone just rings and rings, and I have to answer it in case it's the caseworker, but it's never her. It's just the regular parade of human misery. Pregnant unweds, chronic sufferers, substance abusers. They have to dash off their confessions pretty fast before I hang up. I have to keep the line free. Every phone call I get fills me with joy and terror, since this could be the caseworker or the killer. Approach or avoidance. Positive and negative reinforcement for answering the phone. In the middle of my panic, Fertility calls to say,
"Hi, me again. I've been thinking about you all week. I wanted to ask if it's against the rules for us to meet. I'd really like to meet you."
Still listening for footsteps, expecting a shadow to fall across the crack of light under the hallway door, I'm lifting the window shade to see if anyone's on the fire escape. I ask her, what about her friend? Wasn't she supposed to meet him again today?
"Oh, him," Fertility says. "Yes, I saw him today."
"And?"
"He smells like women's perfume and hairspray," Fertility says. "I don't see what my brother ever saw in him."
The perfume and hairspray were from spraying the roses, but I can't tell her that.
"The other thing is, he had chipped red nail polish on his fingernails.
It was red spray paint from me touching up the roses.
And he's a terrible dancer.
Right now, me getting killed would be redundant.
And his teeth are weird, not rotten, but crooked and little.
You could stab a knife right through my heart, and you'd be too late.
And he has these gross little monkey hands.
Right now, getting killed would be a breath of spring.
That's supposed to mean he has a little wiener dick."
If Fertility keeps talking, my caseworker will have one less client in the morning.
"And he's not obese," Fertility says. "He's not a whale, but he's too fat for me."
In case there's a sniper outside, I open the blinds and stand my gross, obese body in the window. Please, anybody with a rifle and a scope, shoot me right here. Right in my big, fat heart. Right in my little wiener.
"He's not anything like you,"
Fertility says. Oh, I think she'd be surprised how much we're alike.
"You're so mysterious."
I ask, if she could change any one thing about this guy at the mausoleum, what would it be?
"Just so he'd quit pestering me," she says. "I'd kill him."
Well, she's not alone there. Be my guest. Take a number and stand in line.
"Forget about him,"
she says, and her voice is sinking deeper in her throat.
"I called because I want to get you off. Tell me what you want me to do. Make me do something terrible."
Opportunity knocks. Here's the next part of my big plan. This is something I'll go to hell for, but I tell her, "That guy you don't like, I want you to go screw his brains out and then tell me what it was like." She says,
"No way, no day."
Then I'm hanging up. She says,
"Wait, what if I call you and lie? I could just make the whole thing up. You wouldn't know."
"No," I say. "I'd know. I could tell."
"No way am I going to sleep with that geek."
"What if she just kissed him?" Fertility says.
"No."
"What if she just took him out on a date? They could just go out for the afternoon. Get him out of the mortuary, and he might look better. Take him on a picnic. Do something fun." Fertility says,
"Then will you get together with me?"
"Definitely." 35. The sun wakes me up where I'm crouched next to the stove with a butcher knife in my fist. The way I feel, the idea of getting killed isn't so bad. My back hurts. My eyes feel cut open with a razor. I get dressed, and I go to work. I sit in the back of the bus so no one can sit behind me with a knife, a poison dart, a piano wire garret. At the house where I work, the regular caseworker's car is in the driveway. On the lawn are some normal, red-looking birds walking around in the grass. The sky is blue-colored the way you'd expect. Nothing looks out of the ordinary. In the house, the caseworker is on all fours scrubbing the kitchen tile with bleach and ammonia so strong it makes the air around her go all wavy with toxins that bring tears to my eyes.
"I hope you don't mind," she says, still scrubbing. "This was in your daily planner for you to do today. I came over early."
Bleach plus ammonia equals deadly chlorine gas. The tears rolling down my cheeks, I ask, "Did she get my messages?" The caseworker does most of her breathing through a cigarette. The fumes must be nothing to her.
"No, I called in sick," she says. "This cleaning thing is just so fulfilling. There's some coffee and homemade muffins I just baked. Why don't you just relax?"
I ask, does she want to hear all about my problems? Take some notes. The killer called me last night. I was awake all night. He's picked me out to kill me. God forbid she should stop scrubbing the floor and get up and call the police for my sake.
"Don't worry,"
she says. She dips her scrub brush in her bucket of cleaning water.
"The suicide rate took a big jump last night. That's why I couldn't face the office this morning."
The way she's scrubbing the floor, it will never come clean again. Once you scrub the clear gloss coat off a vinyl floor with an oxidizer like bleach, you're fucked. When she's done, the floor will be so porous, everything will stain. God forbid I should try and tell her this. She thinks she's doing a great job. I ask, "So how does the high suicide rate keep me alive?"
"Don't you get it? We lost 11 more clients last night. 9 the night before. 12 the night before that. We're looking at a landslide here," she says.
"So?"
"With numbers like that every night, if there is a killer, he doesn't need to kill anybody."
She starts singing. Maybe the deadly chlorine gas is having its effect. Her scrubbing does a little soft shoe dance to go with her song. She says,
"This won't sound appropriate, but congratulations."
I'm the last Creedish.
"You're almost the last survivor."
I ask how many others.
"In this town, 1,
she says.
"Nationwide, only 5.
"Let's play like old times," I say. I tell her, "Let's us get out the old diagnostic and statistical manual of mental disorders and pick out a new way for me to go crazy. Let's do it. Just for old times' sake. Get the book." The caseworker sighs and looks down at me, reflected with my face wet with tears in her puddle of dirty scrub water on the floor.
"Listen," she says, "I've got some real work to do here. Besides, the DSM is lost. I haven't seen it in a couple of days."
She scrubs back and forth, saying,
"Not that I miss it."
"Okay, this has been a tough 10 years. Almost all her clients are gone. She's stressed out. Burned out. No, incinerated. Cremated. She sees herself as a failure. She's suffering from what's called learned helplessness.
Besides,"
she says, scrubbing hard, here and there at the last spots where the vinyl is still intact,
"I can't hold your hand forever. If you're going to kill yourself, I can't stop you, and it's not my fault. According to my records, you're perfectly happy and adjusted. We have the tests. There's empirical evidence to prove it."
The fumes in here make it so I have to sniff back my tears.
She says, "Kill yourself or don't kill yourself, but stop torturing me. I'm trying to move on with my life."
She says,
"Every day in America, people kill themselves. The problem isn't worse just because you know most of them."
She says,
"Don't you think it's time you cut your own meat?"
34. The rumor was you had to squeeze a frog to death with your bare hand. You had to eat a live earthworm. To prove you could obey just as Abraham did when he tried to kill his own son to make God happy, you had to cut off your little finger with an axe. That was the rumor. After that, you had to cut off someone else's little finger. You never saw anybody after they were baptized, so you couldn't tell if they still had a little finger. You couldn't ask them if they had to squeeze the frog. Right after you were baptized, you got on a truck and left the colony. You'd never see the colony again. The truck was headed out into the wicked outside world, where they already had your first work assignment lined up for you. The big outside world, with all its wonderful new sins, and the better you did on the tests, the better job you'd get. You could figure out what some of the tests were going to be. The church elders told you right up front if you were too skinny or too fat for how tall you were. They set aside the whole year before your baptism for you to get yourself perfect. You were excused from work at home, so you could go to special lessons all day. Bible lessons, cleaning lessons, etiquette, fabric care, and you know all the rest. If you were fat, you ate to lose weight. And if you were too skinny, you just ate. That whole year before baptism, every tree, every friend, everything you saw had the halo around it of your knowing you'd never see it again. By what you studied, you knew about most of the tests you'd get. Beyond that, the rumor was there was more we didn't know would happen. We knew by rumor that you'd be bare naked for part of the baptism. One church elder would put his hand on you and tell you to cough. Another elder would slide a finger up your anus. Another church elder would follow along with you and write on a card how well you did. You didn't know how you were supposed to study for a prostate exam. We all knew the baptisms took place in the meeting house basement. The daughters went to baptism in the spring with only the church women in attendance. Sons went in the fall with only the men there to tell you to get up on the scale naked and be weighed, or ask you to recite a chapter verse from the Bible. Job, chapter 14, verse 5. Seeing his days are determined, the number of his months are with thee. Thou hast appointed his bounds that he cannot pass. And you had to recite it naked. Psalm 101, Psalms of David, verse 2. I will behave myself wisely in a perfect way. I will walk within my house with a perfect heart. You had to know how to make the best dust cloths, soak rags in diluted turpentine, then hang them to dry. You had to figure how deep to set a 6-foot-tall gatepost so it could support a 5-foot-wide gate. Another church elder would blindfold you and give you cloth samples to feel, and you had to say which was cotton or wool or a polycotton blend. You had to identify houseplants, stains, insects, fix small appliances, do elegant handwriting for invitations. We guessed about the tests from what we had to study in school. Other parts came from sons who weren't too bright. Sometimes your father would tell you inside information, so you might score a little higher and get a better job assignment instead of a lifetime of misery. Your friends would tell each other, and then everybody would know. Nobody wanted to embarrass their family, and nobody wanted a lifetime of removing asbestos. The church elders were going to stand you in one place, and you'd have to read a chart at the far end of the meeting hall. The church elders would give you a needle and thread, and time how long you took to sew on a missing button. We knew about what kind of jobs we were headed for in the wicked outside world, from what the elders said to scare or inspire us. To make us work harder, they told us about wonderful jobs in gardens bigger than anything we could picture this side of heaven. Some jobs were in palaces so enormous you'd forget you were indoors. These gardens were called amusement parks. The palaces, hotels. To make us study even harder, they told us about jobs where you'd spend years pumping cesspools, burning offal, spraying poisons, removing asbestos. There were jobs so terrible, they told us we'd be glad to run up and meet death halfway. There were jobs so boring, you'd find ways to cripple yourself so you couldn't work. So you memorized every minute of your last year in the church district colony. Ecclesiastes, chapter 10, verse 18. By much slothfulness, the building decayeth, and through idleness of the hands, the house droppeth through. Lamentations, chapter 5, verse 5. Our necks are under persecution. We labor and have no rest. To keep bacon from curling, chill it a few minutes in the freezer before frying. Rub the top of your meatloaf with an ice cube, and the meatloaf won't crack while it bakes. To keep lace crisp, iron it between sheets of waxed paper. We were kept busy learning. We had a million facts to remember. We memorized half of the Old Testament. We thought all this teaching was to make us smart. What it did was make us stupid. With all the little facts we learned, we never had the time to think. None of us ever considered what life would be like cleaning up after a stranger every day, washing dishes all day, feeding a stranger's children, mowing a lawn all day, painting houses year after year, ironing bedsheets forever and ever, work without end. We were all of us so excited about passing tests, we never looked beyond the night of the baptism. We were all so worried about our worst fears, squeezing frogs, eating worms, poisons, asbestos. We never considered how boring life would be, even if we succeeded and got a good job. Washing dishes forever. Polishing silver. Forever. Mowing the lawn. Repeat. The night before the baptism, my brother Adam took me out on the back porch of our family's house and gave me a haircut. Every other family member in the church district colony with a 17-year-old son was giving him the exact same haircut. In the wicked outside world, they called this product standardization. My brother told me not to smile, but to stand straight up and down and answer any questions in a clear voice. In the outside world, they call this marketing. My mother was putting my clothes together in a bag for me to take with me. We were all of us pretending to sleep that night. In the wicked outside world, my brother told me, there were sins the church didn't know enough to forbid. I couldn't wait. The next night was our baptism, and we did everything we'd expected. Then, nothing else. Just when you're ready to hack off your little finger and the finger of the son next to you, nothing happened. After you'd been poked and felt and weighed and questioned about the Bible and housework, then they told you to get dressed. You took your bag with your extra clothes inside, and you walked from the meeting house into a truck that was idling outside. The truck drove out into the wicked outside world, into the night, and nobody you knew would ever see you again. You never found out how high you scored. Even if you knew you'd done well, that good feeling didn't last very long. There was already a work assignment waiting for you. God forbid you should ever get bored and want more. It was church doctrine that the rest of your life would be the same work, the same being alone. Nothing would change. Every day. This was success. Here was the prize. Mowing the lawn, and mowing the lawn, and mowing the lawn. Repeat. 33. On the bus on the way to our third date, Fertility and I are sitting in front of some guy when we overhear the joke. The temperature is 89 degrees, too hot for June anywhere, and the bus windows are open, with the smell of traffic making me a little sick. The vinyl seats are hot the way touching anything will feel in hell hot. The bus is Fertility's idea for going downtown. On a date, she told me. Downtown. It's the afternoon, so only people without jobs, or with night jobs, or crazy people with Tourette syndrome are going anywhere. Here's the date she has to take me on since she won't sleep with me, and won't even kiss me. No way. No day. Who's sitting behind us, I can't imagine. He was nobody to notice. Just a guy in a shirt. Blonde hair. If you pressed me, I'd have to say ugly. I don't remember. The bus comes by the mausoleum every 15 minutes, and we just got on. We met at Crypt 678, the same as every time. I do remember the joke. It's an old joke. Houses of the city are going by outside the bus. Behind, cars parked along the curb and between fences to mark the property lines. And the Joker leans his head between Fertility and me and whispers, "What's harder than getting a camel through the eye of a needle?" These jokes are all over. No matter how not funny they are, you can't not hear them. Neither Fertility or me says anything back. And the Joker whispers, "Buying life insurance to cover a Cretish church member." The truth is, nobody laughs at these jokes, except me. And I only laugh so I'll fit in. I laugh so I won't not fit in. The main thing I worry about in public is maybe people can tell I'm a survivor. The church costume I got rid of years ago. God forbid I should look like one of those stupid, crazy people in the Midwest who all killed themselves because they thought their God was calling them home. My mother, my father, my brother Adam, my sisters, my other brothers, they're all dead and in the ground getting laughed at. But I'm alive. I still have to live in this world and get along with people, so I laugh. Because I have to do something. Make some noise, shout, scream, cry, swear, howl. I laugh. It's all just different ways to vent. These jokes are everywhere this morning, and you have to do something not to start crying all the time. Nobody laughs harder than me. The Joker whispers, "Why did the Kretish cross the road?" Maybe he's not even talking to Fertility and me. Because he couldn't get any cars to hit him. Behind everybody is the roar of the bus, pushed down the street by its engine in the back, putting out stink-colored smoke. Today, all the jokes are because of the newspaper. From where I sit, I can see the headline below the fold on the front pages of five people hiding behind today's morning edition. It says, "Cult Survivors Dwindle." The article says how the curtain is almost closed on the tragedy of the Kretish Church mass suicide 10 years ago. The article says how the last surviving members of the Kretish Church, the cult based in central Nebraska that committed mass suicide rather than face an FBI investigation and national attention, well, the newspaper says only 6 church members are known to still exist. They don't name names, but I must be one of the last half dozen. The rest of the story jumps to page A9, but you get the gist. When you read between the lines, it says, "Good riddance." They don't write anything about suspect deaths where it looked like murder. There's nothing about how a killer is maybe stalking those last 6 church survivors. Behind me, the Joker whispers, "What do you call a Kretish with blonde hair?" In my head, I tell him, "Dead." I've heard all these jokes. "What do you call a Kretish with red hair?" "Dead." "With brown hair?" "Dead." The guy whispers, "What's the difference between a Kretish and a corpse?" "Just a matter of hours." The guy whispers, "What did the Kretish yell when the hearse drove by?" "Taxi." The guy whispers, "How can you pick out a Kretish on a crowded bus?" Someone pulls the cord for the next stop and rings the bell, and Fertility twists around to say, "Shut up!" She goes loud enough to bring people out from behind their newspapers. She says, "You're joking about suicide. About people that people loved that are dead. So just shut up." It's really loud, she says this. How bright her eyes are, gray but looking silver. It makes me wonder if Fertility isn't Kretish, or if she's still peeved about her brother being dead. She's being such an overreaction. The bus pulls to the curb right then, and the Joker gets up in the aisle and starts out. The same as in church. We're sitting in the bench seats, with the aisle down the middle of the bus. The guy waiting in line to get off. His pants are the baggy brown wool only a survivor would wear in this heat. The church costume suspenders crisscross his back. The brown wool jacket is folded over his arm. He shuffles up the aisle of the bus. He stops a minute while other people get off, and he turns and just touches the brim of his straw hat. He's familiar from somewhere, but it's been so long. His smell is sweat and wool and straw of a farm. Where I know him from, I can't remember. His voice, I remember. His voice, just his voice, over my shoulder into my telephone. "May you die with all your work done." His face is the face I see in the mirror. Not even thinking, I say his name out loud. "Adam. Adam Branson." The Joker says, "Do I know you from somewhere?" But I say no. The line moves a few steps, taking him farther away, and he says, "Didn't we grow up together?" And I say no. Standing at the door of the bus, he shouts, "Aren't you my brother?" And I shout, "No." And he's gone. Luke, chapter 22, verse 34. "Thou shalt thrice deny that thou knowest me." The bus starts back into traffic. The only way to describe the guy is ugly. geeky, a tad overweight, a loser, pathetic at best, a victim, my big brother by 3 minutes, a creedish. According to her body language, the psychology textbooks would say fertility is pissed off at me for laughing. Her legs are crossed at the knee and ankle. She looks out the window as if where we're at is any different. According to my daily planner, right now I should be waxing the dining room floor. There's the gutters to clean. There's a stain to clean up in the driveway where I work. I should be peeling the white asparagus for dinner tonight. I shouldn't be out on a date with a lovely and angry fertility Hollis, even if I killed her brother, and she has the secret hots for my voice on the phone at night, but can't stand me in person. The truth is, it doesn't matter what I should do, what any survivor should do. According to everything we grew up believing, we're corrupt, and evil, and unclean. The air moving along downtown in the bus with us is hot and dense, mixed in with bright sunlight and burning gasoline. Flowers move by, planted in the ground, roses that should have a smell, red, yellow, orange, all the way open but without effect. The 6 lanes of traffic move along relentless as a conveyor belt. Everything we can do is wrong as long as we're still alive. The feeling is you have no control. The feeling is that we're being delivered. It's not like we're traveling. We're being processed. It's more like we're just waiting. It's just a matter of time. There's nothing I can do right, and my brother's out there to kill me. The buildings of downtown start to pile up along the sidewalk. The traffic gets slow. Fertility lifts her arm to pull the cord. Ding. And the bus stops to let us out in front of a department store. Artificial men and women are posed in the windows wearing clothes, smiling, laughing, pretending to have a good time. I know just how they feel. The clothes I'm wearing are just pants and a plaid shirt, but they belong to the man who I work for. All morning I was upstairs trying on different combinations of clothes and going downstairs to where the caseworker was vacuuming lampshades to ask her what she thought. There's a big clock above the doors into the store, and Fertility looks up. She says to me, "Hurry! We have to be there by 2 o'clock." She takes my hand in her amazing cold hand, cold and dry even in the heat, and we push in through the doors, into the air conditioning, and first floor with piles of what's there to buy on tables and inside glass cases locked. "We have to be on the 5th floor, Fertility says, her hand tight around mine and pulling. We charge up the escalators. 2nd floor men's, 3rd floor children's, 4th floor junior miss, 5th floor women's. That kind of recorded music comes out of the vents in the ceiling. It's a cha-cha. 2 slow steps and 3 fast. There's a crossover step and a woman's underarm turn. Fertility taught me. This is less of a date than I thought. Clothes on racks, hanging on hangers. Salespeople walking around dressed really well and asking if they can help. None of this is anything I haven't seen before. I ask, "Does she want to dance here?"
"Wait a minute," Fertility says. "Just wait."
What happens first is the smell of smoke.
"Back here," Fertility says, and leads me into the forest of long dresses for sale.
Then, what happens is bells start ringing, and people head for the escalators, stepping down them the way they would ordinary stairs since the escalators are stopped. People are walking down the up escalator, and this looks as wrong as breaking a law. A sales lady empties out her register into a zippered bag, and looks across the floor at some people by the elevators, standing, looking up at the elevator numbers, holding big glossy shopping bags with handles and stuff folded inside. The bells are still ringing. The smoke is thick enough for us to watch it roll across the lights in the ceiling.
"Don't use the elevators,"
the sales lady shouts.
"When it's a fire, the elevators don't work. You'll have to use the stairs."
She rushes over to them through the maze of clothes on racks, the zippered bag tucked under her arm.